This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Discover how to lead a better life in our age of confusion. Enjoy this BBC audiobook collection, written and presented by best-selling author Oliver Berkman, containing four useful guides to tackling some central ills of modernity: busyness, anger, the insistence on positivity, and the decline of nuance.
Our lives today can feel like miniature versions of this relentless churn of activity. We find we're rushing around more crazily than ever. Somewhere, when we weren't looking, it's like busyness became a way of life.
Start listening to Oliver Berkman, Epidemics of Modern Life, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jaleel, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 13th of January, these are our main stories. China reports its biggest ever trade surplus of nearly $1 trillion, even as it prepares for Donald Trump to carry out his threat to impose tariffs. The BBC finds that people making clothes in China for the fast fashion giant Shein are working more than 75 hours a week, contravening labour laws. Firefighters in Los Angeles brace for the return of strong winds, which they warn could trigger explosive fire growth. Also in this podcast...
Amazing. India is a spiritual heart of the world. I feel amazing. The water is cold, but the heart is warm.
Millions of people are taking part in India's huge religious festival, the Kumbh Mela, on the banks of the Ganges. There's hardly anywhere on earth that Chinese goods don't reach. And now China has reported its largest ever annual trade surplus, amounting to nearly $1 trillion. Yes, that's right, nearly $1 trillion last year. This comes as the country is experiencing a property crisis, stuttering economic growth, and the threat of hefty tariffs on Chinese goods by the incoming US President Donald Trump, sparking fears of a trade war between the world's two economic superpowers. Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, explained why China's exports are doing so well despite the country's many problems.
Remember that the Chinese economy is actually massive, second only to the United States. Its tentacles reach across the world, as you indicated there. So it's not really surprising that it does have a large surplus and that it's recorded this surplus. It's done it primarily because it's pushed the government exports since the pandemic. It's always been exports, the basis of its economic growth. The government has pushed that recently. Also, demand within the country has been quite sluggish, quite low, and so imports aren't growing nearly as much as exports, and so the surplus is the difference between the two, and so that's exaggerated it. And the third reason is that you touched on there, is that Donald Trump coming into office in America has threatened to impose tariffs on Chinese goods. A lot of exporters are just getting their exports into America particularly before that might arise.
So they're kind of front-loading them to get them out there before Donald Trump enters the White House. Well, we've heard that he's already threatening tariffs. So the news about the surplus figures will probably further increase tensions, not just between Beijing and Washington, but also between Beijing and other trading partners like the European Union.
Trade isn't just an economic issue, it's a political issue as well. If China's in surplus, then somebody's in deficit, and no country likes to be giving money away to other countries. And so you see in the European Union, America, there's a political groundswell to try and rebalance this deficit as it is in their countries with China, to sell more to China, to take in fewer imports. At the moment, the European Union is trying to restrict the import of Chinese electric vehicles to protect its own market. So there's a political aspect to this which will play out when President Trump becomes the president again in a week's time.
With all kinds of implications for the global economy.
All kinds of implications for the global economy, and primarily as well for the Chinese economy. As I suggested earlier, economic growth in China has been built primarily on exports, also on infrastructure spending in China, but primarily on exports. Now, if your main driver of growth is facing problems because people are going to put tariffs on your exports, you're not going to be able to sell as many to the outside world, that's a problem for China. So they're going to be pretty worried about what's going to happen this year.
Mickey Bristow. Well, we stay with the issue of Chinese exports and the people who work hard to produce them. The BBC has found that factory workers in China making clothes for the fast fashion giant Shein are working more than 75 hours a week in contravention of the country's labour laws. Such long hours are not unusual in the southern city of Guangzhou, but the BBC's findings will add to a growing list of questions about what conditions are like in its factories. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker spent the day speaking to those toiling around the clock in the so-called Shein village.
The machines seldom stop in this factory, producing clothes for the fast fashion giant Shein. The workers listen to podcasts or cooking shows as they stitch or steam fabric. More than a dozen workers told the BBC they do this for 75 hours a week in contravention of Chinese labour laws. Most have only one day off a month. Outside, scooters rush through a warren of more than 5,000 factories, which make up the so-called Shein village in Guangzhou. At a nearby job market, workers looking for a daily paycheck examine the stitching of the kind of clothes they'd be expected to make. They get paid per piece. Their skill and speed dictate how much they make.
What do you usually make?
It depends on how difficult the item is. Something simple like a T-shirt is 1 to 2 yuan per piece, and I can make around a dozen in an hour. We earn so little. How is that enough? The cost of living is now so high.
Workers travel thousands of miles to Guangzhou to earn money to send back to their families. Shein is now one of their major employers.
I worked with Shein at their first year. I watched it grow. I think Shein will get stronger and better.
There's an almost constant supply of fabric from nearby vendors. Shein's success has been possible because this city in China has everything it needs.
We've come to the textile district of Guangzhou. It's only about 10 minutes from the actual factories, and it is bustling this lunchtime. There are dozens of workers lifting heavy rolls of fabric onto trucks, onto cars, and onto, would you believe it, scooters. Now, I have no idea how they are balancing it, but on one scooter, there's at least 7 rolls of fabric.
Later, as dinner time approaches, street vendors set up stalls selling food or even offering haircuts for workers on their dinner break. Long hours are simply a way of life, and a 75-hour week is not unusual in this industrial heartland.
Well, it's not unusual, you say, but it's clear that it's illegal and it violates basic human rights.
David Hatchfield is from the Swiss advocacy group Public Eye, which has also uncovered excessive working hours in factories producing clothes for Shein.
It's an extreme form of exploitation that happens, and this needs to be visible.
In a statement, Shein told the BBC that it is committed to ensuring the fair and dignified treatment of all workers within its supply chain. And Shein says it's investing tens of millions of dollars in strengthening governance and compliance. Shein also said it was striving to set the highest standards for pay. As workers head in for the last few hours of their shift, some tell us it's their duty to work hard.
This is what we Chinese need to sacrifice for our country's development.
It's just gone 10 p.m. and finally some of the factories are beginning to empty. But I'm standing outside one factory that is still going. It seems in this part of China, the textile capital of the world, is not a place that ever fully goes to sleep.
Laura Bicker reporting. After nearly a week of battling wildfires across Los Angeles that have claimed at least 24 lives, a local fire chief, Chad Augustine, says the next few days will be critical as strong winds are forecast again.
We just stepped right back into red flag conditions with increased winds. That's going to go through Wednesday night with the peak winds on Tuesday and Tuesday night. We got our work cut out for us still.
CBS reporter Charlie DeMar is in Los Angeles.
I've talked to a lot of people who have been trying to return to their homes, and they can't even recognize their own homes. They have lived here for decades. They know the street where they live at. They've even cross-referenced it with their phone. Now, as for the weather, firefighters did make great progress over the weekend. The winds were a bit calmer, so they did get ahead of the fire, and also a lot of resources were called in, a lot more resources than in the beginning when this fire started. There are firefighters from around the country, and this is also an international battle now. There are helicopters and aircraft from Canada, and firefighters also from Mexico have joined the front lines. But the big concern are those Santa Ana winds that are moving in, and it could bring wind gusts up to 60 miles per hour. Where we are now, residents aren't allowed back in here yet. There's a number of reasons for that. One's the safety reason. There's power lines down, and it just wouldn't be safe for people to go in. And also, leaders here are urging people not to sift through their belongings because they're concerned about some of the toxic materials that could be contained in the ash. The National Guard has been called in to help with security, and there has been arrests, about almost 30 arrests for looting.
Charlie DeMar from CBS News. Even as there's no let-up in Israel's relentless bombardment of Gaza, particularly in the north, we're hearing optimistic noises once again that a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas could soon be agreed. Hopes have been raised many times before at the talks in Qatar, only to be dashed. Donald Trump says he wants to see the Israeli hostages held in Gaza released before he takes office in just a week's time. Otherwise, he said, there will be all hell to pay. In a conflict which has already seen more than 46,000 Palestinians and more than 1,000 Israelis killed. So will there be a deal this time? Emma Nader in Jerusalem is following developments.
There is a sense that in the next days before the inauguration of President Trump, we will have something, but it's not necessarily clear what that will be. Many leaks are being shared and published in various media outlets, but it's quite hard to divine exactly where we are inside the negotiating rooms there in Qatar. But the signals are positive. The intelligence chiefs of Israel remained there over the weekend to engage with the talks, which were seen as a positive sign. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke on the phone last night with President Biden to discuss the deal. Again, very encouraging, and that's the only the first time in 3 months that the two have had a publicly announced phone call. Even in the Israeli press, we heard that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been trying to persuade the more radical members, anti-deal members of his cabinet, not to resign in protest. So it looks like the momentum is heading in the right direction with this deadline of the change of administration, which could, if a deal of some sort isn't reached before then, you know, it could provoke the ire of President Trump. So we still don't know about certain key issues of the deal exactly.
Right. Meanwhile, the fighting is still going on in Gaza.
That's right. So over the weekend, we've seen more deadly strikes. Just one this morning on a school sheltering displaced people there in Gaza City, which local authorities said have killed four. There was also four IDF Israeli military soldiers reported dead over the weekend. So the fighting isn't letting up. And in the north of Gaza, where for 2 or 3 months now there's been a near total siege, according to the UN, on food and aid getting into certain parts of northern Gaza, humanitarian agencies are still banging the drum saying, you know, more aid needs to get into those areas of northern Gaza because it's a very desperate situation in terms of access to food and access to medical care and treatment there.
Emir Nader. One of the world's largest religious festivals is being held in India, the Kumbh Mela, which takes place every 12 years on the river Ganges. The six-week event, attended by millions of Hindu devotees, is so big that it can be seen from space. Our South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain is there and described the scene.
I'm standing probably just a few feet away from where the Ganges River meets the Yamuna River and the mythical Saraswati River. Hindus believe by going into the waters here at this particular moment will actually purify one's soul and rid them of evil. And it's all part of this 45-day-long festival called the Maha Kumbh Mela. And it really only happens once every 12 years.
And it attracts huge numbers of people.
Organizers are expecting there's going to be 400 million people that'll come to this festival over the next month and a half. And what's really interesting is that because this is a religious festival and that's what brings devotees here, but it also has taken on a very much like a festival type atmosphere. So, you know, actually just walking in front of me are two men carrying these mountainous sizes of cotton candy to be sold. And there's someone else that's doing acrobatics or, you know, kind of like a mini circus. And in different pockets of this enormous fairgrounds, you have different religious services that are happening. People are dressed as gods and there's music.
And authorities are expecting, just to give you a sense of the size of this, the first ritual dip to draw more than 2.5 million visitors who will go into the freezing waters of the river there.
This morning, I was actually here when the first pilgrims went into the water, and I can tell you that I was wearing quite a few layers. It was very, very cold this morning, but you saw people that were stripping down into a pair of shorts and were leaping into the water and then bathing in the water, putting their entire bodies in and their heads in and out. I was quite amazed.
She just said that she has gone into the water and she feels really good. That walking here, she was feeling quite cold, but when she went into the river, she didn't feel cold anymore.
And it must be a huge logistical challenge because you've got to provide accommodation, food, all kinds of services for all these people descending on this part of India. And there are also security and safety concerns, I imagine.
So just to give you a sense of how large this fairground is, it's about 40 square kilometers. That's about, you know, 4,000 football pitches. I mean, that's just how big this is. And every section of the fairground is housing different things. So in one section, you'll have where sort of the common man will go and they have tents set up where they are going to be staying, some for a few days, some for a few weeks, and some for the entire festival. Then in other sections, you have the religious leaders or the babas, as they're called. And they have set up these, in some cases, some really ornate tents, and people will go and sit there, and passers-by are invited in to have some tea and to listen to the Baba speak or to get some life advice. It is a logistical nightmare to try and organize all of this. You know, everywhere you look, you see, you know, there are bathroom facilities, there are specific media facilities, and there's also food vendors absolutely everywhere. Because, I mean, after all, this is India, and the country takes food very, very seriously.
Samira Hussain at the Kumbh Mela in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh. Still to come on the Global News podcast, with Donald Trump saying he wants to buy Greenland, our special correspondent Fergal Keane has been there to see what Greenlanders themselves want.
We are very much telling this story that it has to be about independence or not independence. People want independence, but not at any cost.
Discover how to lead a better life in our age of confusion. Enjoy this BBC audiobook collection, written and presented by best-selling author Oliver Berkman, containing four useful guides to tackling some central ills of modernity: busyness, anger, the insistence on positivity, and the decline of nuance.
Our lives today can feel like miniature versions of this relentless churn of activity. We find we're rushing around more crazily than ever. Somewhere, when we weren't looking, it's like busyness became a way of life.
Start listening to Oliver Berkman, Epidemics of Modern Life, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast. We go to Texas now, the US state which has some of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country, as a consequence of the US Supreme Court decision 3 years ago to overturn Roe v. Wade. Abortion is banned in almost all circumstances from as early as 6 weeks. The law also offers $10,000 to any American reporting an abortion provider or anyone else involved in the process. Some doctors are leaving Texas because they don't feel they can provide proper care for women under this law. Dr. Zoe Kornberg is one of those. She was doing her residency training with an obstetrics and gynecology program in Texas, but her personal experiences left her feeling she couldn't look after women safely. She told Melanie Abbott why she felt she had to leave.
It felt like you couldn't even speak about abortion, that even talking about it with a patient could be perceived as helping them get one, even if that wasn't your intention or you were just sort of explaining to a patient what an abortion was. Not all pregnancies have a good outcome. Many women will experience a miscarriage or pregnancy complications other than a miscarriage before viability of the fetus, but well past the 6-week mark. And there were many occasions where we really felt like our hands were tied.
And what did that mean for the care of the women you were looking after?
When women would come in bleeding and cramping from a miscarriage, for many patients, there came a switch where they were bleeding too much and the process was taking too long. And ordinarily, we would act very quickly, perform a DNC, a dilation and curettage, to evacuate the uterus and stop the bleeding. And instead, it meant that there were these delays. The law does not well define what an emergency is. And so we would spend hours jumping through administrative hoops, trying to get permission for this very simple, short procedure that would prevent an emergency from happening. We didn't feel that we could trust our staff because were they going to report us because they were interpreting the situation differently? Or were we going to have to wait and wait and wait until staff who was comfortable participating in the care came on call? And were the people who we were seeking permission from, the other doctors, the administrators, were they going to agree with us? And then meanwhile, the patient is bleeding out. And that just feels horrible as a physician. You know, I went into medicine because I wanted to prevent pain and suffering for my patients. And here was a person experiencing pain and suffering that I knew exactly how to stop. I couldn't do it. There were days that were really demoralizing. And in any other state or context, that would be malpractice. But this law is forcing me to wait and wait and wait until the patient needs a blood transfusion, which carries risks and can cause complications, to wait until maybe the patient is infected. Maybe that becomes septic shock and she ends up in the ICU. It opens up the possibilities for permanent disability, longer hospitalizations, losing her uterus or her ability to conceive in the future. It's a recipe for disaster.
Dr. Zoe Kornberg talking to Melanie Abbott. And for more on this story, listen to the latest episode of Woman's Hour wherever you get your BBC podcasts. To Kenya now, where Amnesty International say a renowned Tanzanian rights activist has been kidnapped on the streets of the capital, Nairobi, over the weekend. But after an outcry on social media, Maria Chetsahi was released hours later. In a video posted on X, she said she was safe and that she would talk in the coming hours about her ordeal. Our Africa security correspondent, Ian Wafula, spoke to Rob Young from Nairobi.
Up until the video that was posted by Maria yesterday, she was definitely visibly shaken. But hours before that, at about 4 p.m., she is said to have sent out a distress call to her friends and colleagues at Amnesty International saying that she has been abducted. She was within one of the high-end areas at the capital, Nairobi, when three armed men in a black Toyota Noah ambushed her and forced her into the vehicle. She was just about to board a taxi she had hailed. There's a dramatic video that has been circulating online where we are seeing a bus, a public service bus, kind of trying to stop these men, and people were yelling and they were saying, "Let her go. We cannot continue having these kind of abductions." And you could visibly see members of the public trying to do whatever they can to try and stop this particular vehicle from moving. But unfortunately, they took her. After which Amnesty International posted that Maria had been abducted.
So is it clear then who may have taken her?
Up until this point, it is not clear, because we're yet to also hear from the Kenyan police officers on exactly what transpired. However, just to mention, Change Tanzania, which is a movement by Maria, said in a statement on X that they believe that she was taken by Tanzanian security agents operating beyond Tanzania borders to silence government critics. Rob.
And we did have a Ugandan opposition leader, didn't we? Kizza Besigye, last year, kidnapped by Ugandan security officials in Kenya. And there have been a spate of kidnappings in the country over the last year.
Yeah, that is right. And of course, it remains a huge concern. In fact, when you listen to people or when you read comments online, people are describing Nairobi particularly as the capital of abductions just because of what has happened over the last couple of months. In fact, in December, just towards the end of the year, there were protests in Nairobi over the recent cases of abductions where a number of young people, about five of them, had been abducted just towards Christmas over what people believed were sentiments and images they had posted online that were criticizing the government. So there is a lot of concern about why this is happening. We also did have a statement from President William Ruto, who said that they will end abductions. However, he went on to say that young people need to kind of behave and be watchful in the manner in which they're raising some of their concerns.
Ian Wafula in Kenya. Few places in the world feel more remote than the snow-covered peaks of Greenland. The world's largest island that sits beneath the North Pole is home to fewer than 60,000 people. But now it finds itself at the centre of a geopolitical storm, as Donald Trump says he wants to buy the autonomous territory, currently part of Denmark, for what he calls economic security. Our special correspondent, Virgil Keane, has been to visit Greenland.
The fjord has depths around 300, 500, all the way in.
Deep.
Yeah.
The sun has just come up here on Luke Ford, and the water around me is flat and calm. On either side, mountains climb up, snow-covered here in the deep winter of the Arctic. This is an old front line from Cold War days, but it's taken on a new significance as the next American president is threatening to take Greenland by force, if necessary.
Welcome to farm.
Welcome to Son. This wonderful place.
Yes.
Angutimerik Hansen and his family hunt and raise sheep for a living. From his front door, the short winter sunlight dazzles on the flat waters of Nuuk Fjord. But even here, a two-hour boat ride from the capital, they're talking about President Trump and his threats to buy or invade.
What the stupid human in the world like a Trump.
That's yeah. What you feel?
Yeah. I mean, we think about US and Trump, this is different. We need to work together with US, not Trump.
It isn't just the shock any community would feel at the prospect of being bought or invaded by a superpower. They fought hard here to preserve Inuit culture after Danish colonists first arrived in the 18th century. I met local church elder Kalirak Ringsted, age 73, as he was drying strips of cod fished from the water near his front door.
In our opinion, it's wild and weird to hear him speak of our country as something that can just be bought. We don't view it as a purchasable land. We have been here for a long time. We are used to our ways of living.
Here in the capital, Nuuk, there's a feeling among pro-independence supporters that the Trump intervention has at least brought international attention to their cause, though they stress they don't want to be American. The editor of Sermatsak, a local newspaper, Masana Egede, says the energy unleashed by Mr. Trump's comments should lead to a sober debate on Greenland's future.
We are very much telling this story that it has to be about independence or not independence. But there's all of this story that is in between, that people want independence but not at any cost. There's a living standard that has to be maintained. There's trade that has to be maintained. There's living ways that has to be maintained.
The Eskimo are very primitive, and the Danish government is doing its best to keep civilization from spoiling them.
To go to the heart of this, to understand why Greenlanders don't want any new ruler, it's important to know about past racism and abuses, like the campaign in the 60s and 70s to fit thousands of Greenlandic women and girls with contraceptive coils to reduce the population. Melina Abelson, a former finance minister in Greenland, says addressing the injustices of the past is essential to any political moves forward.
I think a lot of people are saying this happened in the past. It's time to move on. Look how great you have done. But you cannot move on if you have not been healed before and if you have actually been acknowledged to what happened to you.
The issues of self-determination and facing the past are intimately intertwined. Now the intervention of Donald Trump has placed both before the eyes of the world. But the message we heard from remote settlements and here in the capital city Nuuk is that Greenland's destiny must be decided among people whose voices have for too long been overlooked.
That report by Fergal Keane. We end in space, or not quite. The company owned by the billionaire Amazon founder Jeff Bezos has been forced to postpone the launch of a new reusable rocket that had been due to blast off from Florida. Blue Origin has already had to delay the launch several times. The rocket is designed to land on a platform in the Atlantic Ocean so that it can be used multiple times. If successful, it could become a serious rival to Elon Musk's SpaceX. So, how much of a setback are these delays for Jeff Bezos' space ambitions? Here's our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
It's a little bit of a blow, but it's normal. This is the first time that he's trying out this rocket, New Glenn. It's a gigantic rocket, 98 metres tall, but in its very first launch, this is expected to happen. If everything isn't going to plan, then call it off, try again another day. So, when Elon Musk tried with his rockets, there were lots of explosions, lots of crashes, lots of delays. So this is part of the development process. Obviously, I'd imagine that Jeff Bezos would want it to have gone up, wanted it to have kind of performed successfully. But I think it was more likely than not that either be a delay or some little bit wouldn't go right. So this is normal. It's part of the development process. But the billionaires will be competing with each other in space very soon. The question is, when New Glenn will be ready for launch. It probably won't be in the next few days because they're draining it of fuel. They'll have to put fuel back into it, which is a time-consuming process. They'll also have to resolve whatever issue it was. And the launch window closes on January the 16th. So I think there's too much to do it in that time, if I were to guess. Who knows, I might be wrong. But it's probably going to be in a few days' time that they're probably going to have another go. Once upon a time, you'd have a launch every now and again. But there are launches every day, so it's a question of air traffic. They've booked these slots, and if they miss their slot, they've got to rebook and convince the Federal Aviation Authority that everything's good to go. So we'll have to wait and see. But once it does launch, we're in store for a really exciting battle between the billionaires, because Elon Musk has achieved great things with Starship and his Falcon rockets. He's flown 400 times into orbit. Jeff Bezos hasn't flown a single time yet, so he's got a lot of catching up to do, but he plans to make up for lost time.
Pallab Ghosh. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was produced by Harry Bly. It was mixed by Callum McLean. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Discover how to lead a better life in our age of confusion. Enjoy this BBC audiobook collection, written and presented by best-selling author Oliver Berkman, containing four useful guides to tackling some central ills of modernity: busyness, anger, the insistence on positivity, and the decline of nuance.
Our lives today can feel like miniature versions of this relentless churn of activity. We find we're rushing around more crazily than ever. Somewhere, when we weren't looking, it's like busyness became a way of life.
Start listening to Oliver Berkman, Epidemics of Modern Life, available to purchase wherever you get your audiobooks.